Good morning, everybody. Jeffrey Swartz here with my compatriot, Brendan Berry. We are both professors of law at Western Michigan University, Cooley Law School. And we are here today to talk about the Constitution and current events and whatever else we feel like espousing. I have to say this before we begin. Good morning, Brendan, by the way.
Good morning, Jeff.
Okay. I have to say that anything that Brendan and I say, any opinions that we set forth, are our own opinions and not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School or its faculty at large. So with the disclaimer out of the way, we move forward. Again, good morning, Brendan. How are you doing, by the way, Brent? Everything okay?
I'm doing fine. Welcome back to Tampa.
Yeah. I was telling Brendan earlier this morning that I'm kind of operating on 7 out of 8 cylinders, a 12-hour drive from North Carolina ended my 18-day sojourn into vacationdom, and it was beautiful up there. I had a wonderful time, but the drive back was just a long one, and here we're talking about we had to be out of there at 10 o'clock, and I was telling Brent we had to be out of this place we were staying at 10 o'clock in the morning, and so we start driving, and the idea was initially, you know, maybe we'll make a stop on the way and finish the drive this morning after I finish the show from wherever I am. And it's about 4:30, and we get to like Jekyll Island. There really is a place called Jekyll Island, by the way.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. In Georgia, it's right near St. Simon's Island. And we get near there because Marilyn used to live in St. Simon's, and she's all up for trying to make a stop. And I'm sitting there saying, it's 4:30 in the afternoon. It's 95 degrees outside. Why am I getting out of this air conditioned car? I decide I'm going to keep driving, okay? And all of a sudden I get to Jacksonville, and it's only like 6:15. And I'm saying, it's 95 degrees out there. Why am I getting out of this car? I'm not staying in Jacksonville. And the next thing I know, a couple hours later, I'm in Ocala. I'm saying I'm on I-75. I'm 2 hours from home. What the hell am I getting out of this car for? Okay, so literally 12 hours to the minute. 5 minutes after 10, we pull up to Marilyn's house so I can drop her stuff off at her house and drop her off at her house. And I felt kind of bad for her because she threw out her back, and every 3 hours or so I got to stop so she can walk around. Okay, she's getting out of the car. I'm not getting out of the car. I get out of the car to put gas in. That's it. Okay, I got everything I need in the car. It's self-contained. Okay. And it takes me an hour to get all of her stuff up to the third floor of her place. Okay, I got to walk up 2 flights of stairs carrying these heavy suitcases and everything else. I get home. My stuff, I get upstairs using a cart. I haven't unpacked the first damn thing. Okay, and all I want to do is go to bed, right? And I get into bed, and I can't sleep because I'm so keyed up from the drive, right? I get to sleep like 12:30, 1 o'clock. It was an adventure. We talked about this on the way home. After 2 weeks with the kids, you know, her grandchildren and then mine, our attitude was that we're going to take a vacation in about 3 or 4 weeks so we can recover from our vacation. I found myself sitting on the deck of this place looking at the deer in the backyard the last night, and I'm in a rocking chair. And all I want to do is just, I don't want to talk. I don't want to look. I just want to lay there. I just want to rock in my chair. And I'm saying, I must be 90 years old. Okay. Yeah. I'm sitting on a porch, rocking in a chair, enjoying the weather. I mean, that's all I want to do. Okay.
Next time you go on vacation, bring a good book. Find a beach, but bring a good book.
Yeah, and in a Corona. Yeah, I got it.
There you go.
Okay.
Right.
Find your beach. Yeah. I got up this morning to get ready for the show. That's how I am. I had to get that off my chest. I really did. So here we are. We start out each show with what do you really think? Those of you who listen to the show know. I usually take off after someone, and I get real passionate in a kind of a loud way, in a kind of an angry way sometimes doing this. Today, I don't want to do that. I have to start this out that these are personal reflections of the father of an Afghan vet. And I remember how I felt. Probably the worst moment that a parent can go through when they send their child off to war. And I remember the greatest feeling that a parent can get when their child comes home from war all in one piece. Yeah. And I understand, although I cannot empathize because my son came back alive, standing up, I can understand the anger of those who lost children in Afghanistan over a 20-year period of time. And in particular, I can understand those feelings of those 13 families who lost a member of their family a week ago. And no one wants to be the last person to die in a war. No one wants to die in a war, period. But no one, it's like the last guy to get drafted in the NFL. He's irrelevant. Never makes the team, but that's what they call him, Mr. Irrelevant. No one wants to be the last person to die in a war or be the family to say, why couldn't peace have come 2 minutes sooner? I really look back on the sacrifice we made, but I look back on what's happened here, and Brendan and I have talked about this last week and maybe the week before a little bit. What happened over there over the last few weeks is truly a tragedy. And it's unfortunate. But you don't, you know, pull out of a war. The war doesn't end just because you leave. And I look back on it and I say to myself, to a great extent, Biden had two choices when he came into office. He could follow his heart and what he believed was that we should be out of there and do the best he could to get us out in some way close to the agreement that Trump left him with, which was basically a recipe for disaster, which occurred. Or he could stick 20,000 more men into Afghanistan to make it clear that we're going to leave when we feel like leaving. And his heart was and has been for 10, 15 years now that we have no business being there after we accomplished the mission that we had gone there for in the first place. And failed, by the way, because we did not get Osama bin Laden at that point. And he chose the latter. I mean, he chose the former, to get out, to follow his heart. And I don't think he was wrong for following his heart. And to that degree, I think that any type of reflection upon this will be in a positive light. Where we fail and where we have to accept that we failed, that somewhere along the line within this administration, and I'm not trying to pile on Biden, something went wrong. Either the military had a bad assessment of what would happen when we left with the Afghan army, or intelligence people failed to recognize how bad things were morale-wise within Afghanistan and that the Taliban success was inevitable, or both of them knew what was going to happen, and Biden did not follow the advice that he was being given. I don't know. One of those three things went wrong. I don't know which one. And it's going to take congressional hearings and things like that to find that out. And they're called for. But to the same extent, I have agreed with Brendan on the thought process, we have to stop piling on. Joe Biden has, throughout the entirety of this procedure, everything that's happened, said the buck stops with him. They're his decisions. He owns it. He's taken responsibility for it. And he piles it on himself by continuing to say that. But it is not necessary for the media to pummel him, to continue to go after him for things that he's already admitted are his responsibility, to repeat the same things over and over again. We know what went wrong. We don't know why. And that is a question worth answering. But as a former, as a father of a former Afghan vet, or a person who is an Afghan vet, I am proud of my son's service. I am proud of the things that he did. I'm proud of the bravery that he showed in the times that he had to show it. I am proud of every single American who served there. I am immensely proud and grateful to those who sacrificed, whether parts of their body or their lives. I think it is time we stand up and be proud of those people, honor them, and stop trying to make their sacrifice, in some people's words, useless when it was not. They protected our country. For 20 years, they went overseas and protected our country. No different than the people who serve in Korea, the people who serve in Germany, the people who serve in the Philippines, the people who serve all around the world. And let's start figuring out where we go from here. And I believe Anthony Blinken last night when he said, we will not stop till we get everybody out. And I don't think they will. Now, how they're going to do that, I think that we're buying Taliban cooperation by giving them information and assistance against ISIS right now. We'll never know. No one's ever going to admit that, but that's what we're doing. And I don't care how we buy the cooperation. The ISIS is bad, but, you know, it's a win-win for us. But let's stop piling on, and let's start moving on. And that's what I think about that.
Yeah. That's, I agree. And before I move on to another topic, just to kind of, as always, dovetail off of your thoughts. You know, there's one person in the media in particular who I've spoken to Jeff about who needs to kind of step off and reevaluate, and that's Richard Engel, who I thought at one time was a serious journalist and a good one, who just can't stop with the hyperbolic hysterics about, you know, he keeps referring to this as the great humiliation. The United States has been humbled. Yesterday, he was quoted as saying, some people, don't you love it when people couch what they think, what some people say? Right? That was a big Trump tactic. So he says, some people say it's the worst capitulation of Western values in our lifetimes. Come on. Joe Biden was the fourth president to inherit this kind of involvement, well, to be involved in Afghanistan. And the first one with the courage to say that I'm going to do, and I talked about this last week, I'm going to do the politically more dangerous thing here, which is instead of just leaving troops there You know, Americans haven't noticed Afghanistan for a long time, right? So just instead of just leaving troops there, just enough, right, to keep the status quo, I'm going to end this war, as you say, right, a war that he thought should have been ended a long time ago. And he deserves credit for that. That's called a profile in courage. And I agree something went wrong, obviously. Multiple things went wrong. But here's my overall point. And again, Jeff and I talked about this before coming on air here. Mistakes in war are not scandals. War is chaos. Now, I've never been in one. I've never had a child in one. I don't have kids. I certainly have had relatives who fought in wars. But I mean, it's common sense that war is chaos. War is a mess. War is a violent, violent undertaking. And more than anything else, war is mass insanity, something only humans could conjure. I wrote a blog post years ago about, believe it or not, I'll come around to something relevant here, about king cobras. I marveled at one trait of king cobras that they've evolved into, and that is, as everybody knows, king cobra, one of the most frightening snakes on the planet. Right? highly poisonous, very large, and just terrifying creature, and quite deadly. The king cobra is not immune to a bite from the venom of another cobra. So they're perfectly capable of killing one another, like they kill their prey. But they have evolved so that when one king cobra comes into the territory of another and there is a conflict, they engage in a wrestling match where they both put their heads up and they do this little dance and they wrestle with each other until one of them pins the other one. And somehow or other in their reptilian brains, the one who is pinned then says, okay, I've lost. It hardwired into their brains is an agreement among the species that they will not fight one another. They won't kill one another. Because evolution demands it. For the evolution of their species, they can't be killing each other. They'd all be dead. And somehow that trait has eluded humans. I marvel again that this snake, this horrifying, dangerous animal, in some ways is more evolved than humans, because we just can't stop killing each other. If we're going to get in the business of doing this, of staying in wars where we're going well beyond the mission that was stated at the beginning, boy, you know, I thought I heard George W. Bush say, I really think I heard him say, we're going to go in there, we're going to get the people who did this to us, and then we're going to get out. And that's not what he did.
Nope.
And the presidents who came after him didn't do it either. And that includes Barack Obama, with whom Joe Biden disagreed, apparently vigorously disagreed. I don't know what people expect. We're going to find out that mistakes were made. And again, you and I had a really good – we had a conversation before coming on that we should have recorded and just played it. But mistakes are made in every war. You rattled off as we were talking. We made mistakes in World War II in the Pacific. Right? We made mistakes
in Europe.
Yeah, you Patton, right? I'll let you take this, but Patton was restrained when he shouldn't have been, right? And so was Nimitz in the Pacific. I mean, yeah, mistakes are made. So Congress can hold hearings, so they're going to find out there were mistakes. But I think the media ought to step back here for a minute and just say, yeah, that's what happens when humans are involved in an endeavor. There's going to be there are going to be mistakes. So I'm sorry, but that, I have to get that off my chest before I move
on. I'm going to ask a question, if I may. You know, what I guess concerns me is, like you said, and you're correct, media is trying to dump all this responsibility and the debacle, or however it wants to be, it's going to be defined eventually, but the battle for Afghanistan, they're blaming it on Biden, yet he was the one, as Brendan said, was against being involved in Afghanistan. He didn't see eye to eye with Barack Obama, who wanted to go in. But my question is, why aren't we placing greater responsibility on the military? Because aren't they the ones that convinced the president at that time, but not the vice president at that time, that this was an appropriate standard? So why do we get involved that way? And is the military astute enough to understand the geopolitical ramifications of it all?
What do you think, Jeff? Do you want to take that? Or
guess not.
Yeah.
We'll move on.
No, it's a good question. I don't know what the military brass, if you will, was advising presidents throughout this time. I think my sense is that the military, or at least anything I was hearing publicly from military leaders was that they can carry out whatever mission the president tells them to. My sense is that politicians put the military in an impossible situation. It seems to me that George W. Bush eventually, I don't know, this could be wrong, but my impression of him was that his thinking evolved from retaliating for what happened on 9/11 to nation building, spreading Jeffersonian democracy at the point of a gun. And that is not a mission that the military can accomplish. I think their inclination is to say, well, we'll accomplish anything you ask us to accomplish, but that's not realistic. Nation building, we have let's be frank, we have a military, right, that is trained to go kill people, right? When unfortunately it becomes necessary for us to do that. They are not trained or equipped to nation build. And my opinion is that that's going to be the macro mistake that was made here. When the historians have a chance to look back on this, that the changing of the mission by political leaders, and I think it started with George W. Bush, from national security, protecting us from terrorism, to nation building, that was the pivot that caused ultimately our failure. As Jeff said now, not every component of the military's mission failed. It definitely is fair to look back and say, look, everybody who went over there for 20 years, we have not been attacked in the homeland by terrorists from abroad. And that's a pretty remarkable record. Again, I think after 9/11, most of us thought this is going to become much more commonplace. So that's just, but it's impossible to know without hearing, the private conversations between presidents and generals and admirals. It's impossible to know what they were advising. I have heard certainly, retired military brass saying, anytime you ask a commander on the ground whether they want more resources or more troops, the answer is likely to be yes, they do. Mm-hmm. So it could very well be that there was, it was mutually reinforcing. You may have had political leaders who wanted the military to achieve an impossible objective, and then on the other end, military people who thought they could achieve the objective and kept on pressuring the political leaders in that direction. Mm-hmm. This was not a problem, and that's kind of the injustice of it, why I got a little worked up about this. of all people who did not participate in creating this problem, Joe Biden is at the top of the list. This was not a problem right. that he created. It's a problem that he solved. And it's tragic, absolutely tragic, that we lost people, 13 very brave Americans who were undertaking probably the most worthwhile mission a human being can undertake, which is to protect other people and their free their passage, hopefully, to a better life, that they were killed. That doesn't – and this is I say this almost every week. As Americans, we have to develop a little better ability to hold multiple ideas in our heads at once. One idea is that this is a tragic loss, and there's no denying it, and that mistakes had to have been made for that to happen. Another idea is it was the right decision to get the United States out. But I don't. It just seems to me the media is incapable of holding both of those ideas at the same time. It's getting to be a problem. And, you know, we usually refer to this hour as the Constitution today. And sometimes it seems like we stray far off the path of actually talking about the Constitution. But all of this comes back to, as again, I say every week, just about every week, the health of our constitutional republic. We live in a constitutional republic, in a quote-unquote democratic republic, where nothing's going to work if we don't have institutions that are functioning, that are healthy. And one of those institutions is the media, and another is the people. The people have to be informed. Ignorance kills. We're finding that out left and right. I'll have more to say about that in a little bit. But we cannot have an ill-informed, misinformed, or ignorant populace. Democracy doesn't work when people have no idea what they're voting for or about. And to that end, we need a healthy, you know, what historians refer to as fourth estate, the media, a free press, that does its job. And instead of feeding us, you know, drama and hysterics, can stick objectively to reporting on what's real and what isn't. I'm not sure if we've lost Jeff. Is Jeff, are you there?
Oh, I can't imagine. Hold on a second. Maybe we did lose him and I wasn't looking at the screen. He may have been off. Okay, well, he heard
okay.
it. Jeff, you're back.
Am I here? Am I back now?
There you go.
I have to admit, I was enjoying Brendan immensely. I mean, Brendan Unleashed. But I
thought
we should put a leash on me sometimes. But
right.
You're going, well, why isn't Jeff saying anything?
Yeah, come on.
I was off for a little bit, but. I have to say that Brendan's thought process is not – I can't disagree with it. I will say this, that we have civilian control over our military and many of our military decisions. And the military is constrained to a great degree of the political will of the people that are behind them. Whether we call it violent, whether it's war is what it is, the truth of the matter is – that they you can only do as much as your people will allow you to do. And it's a political process. War is a political process. It's an explanation. It's a demonstration of political will by one country against another, or one form of government against another. It's the way that we express ourselves when we can't reason with each other. And to that end, it leads you to the other thought of that's what's happening within the country itself. That people are having a hard time. If you want to see what promotes war, just look what's happening within our own country. We are incapable of talking to each other. We are incapable of reasoning with each other. Our political system fails not because it isn't representing the people. It's because it's not doing its job in understanding representation is only one half of what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to be decision makers, policy makers, and they're supposed to make decisions based upon what's good for the country, not necessarily their own reelection bid, and not necessarily what's good for their own constituents, because it may be better for the country than it is for the people that they are directly responsible to. But they're doing what they're supposed to do.
Gravitating toward that, that's a goal. Seems unattainable.
It to a great degree, it is unattainable. Not in the way that our politic has grown up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've said this before, and I'll just allude to this. And that is that the downfall of the American political system as we see it today is caused by one simple act of Congress. They outlawed earmarks. And for those who don't know what earmarks are, they're things within a appropriations bill or any other bill that are designed to provide a benefit for one congressman's district at some point or another congressman. It's the money. I need to build a bridge. I need to build a building. Whatever it may be, get me the money, and I'll give you a vote on what you need. It is that bargaining, that it is, bartering,
yeah,
that took place, that made Congress work, that made bipartisanship happen. And they outlawed earmarking. And when they did that, they took away any desire anybody may have in being bipartisan, because they can't bring home the bacon. And when they did, and that was Newt Gingrich and the Tea Party. And when they did that, they literally destroyed any incentive that Republicans and Democrats have to work together. Why did we get a bipartisan infrastructure bill? Because everybody's bringing home the bacon. So if you want something, if you want to see how this works, there's a movie called Charlie Wilson's War. It is about Afghanistan when we were giving the Mujahideen weapons to fight the Russians. And you watch,
yeah,
Tom Hanks, it being Charlie Wilson, trading off a favor. Yeah, I'll vote for that. So that when I'll vote for that, I'll vote for that, I'll vote for that. And then when he needed favors to get money to send to Afghanistan, he said, you owe me. I want your vote. I want this money. And he got it. So that was the death knell of bipartisanship. It's the way we operated for 200 years. But that wasn't good enough for Newt.
The contract on America.
He's going to change everything. Yeah, I got control over Congress, and I'm not giving anything away. That was his thought process. So that's how we got to where we are. 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that one simple act destroyed the ability of Congress to act in a bipartisan way. And that's,
yeah,
the truth.
And, that's, and those, it's a very interesting point, one I had not really thought too much about. And that certainly makes sense that that's a key input, and that's obviously exacerbated by so much else that's going on. I mean, we're at the point now where it's not just a lack of bipartisanship. It's just two different realities. That's what I never circled back around to my original thought of, you know, what I really think this morning. And this really does tie in. There was a radio host named Mark Bernier, I believe his name was.
Yeah.
who was, you know, a self-proclaimed anti-vaxxer,
right.
who is now one of several high-profile, right, of these anti-vaxxer
mm-hmm.
Folks who died of COVID.
Right.
And many of them on their way out, you know, are saying, oh, geez, you know, I guess I made a mistake here. Well, it's too late now. You've got these large numbers of people. I mentioned this last week, but it's just gotten worse. You know, on the internet, people trying to find this horse dewormer. They won't take an FDA-approved vaccine.
But they're going to let somebody poke them with a horse. No, it's actually a cow. Was it a horse or a cow?
Either. It's livestock.
It's a dewormer.
Yeah, a livestock
dewormer.
Right. Right.
I didn't know that COVID was a worm.
Right.
I thought it was a virus. Obviously, it's a worm.
That's.
Question I have. Brendan brings up a really good point, and that is, are we not able to decipher our history because we don't remember it anymore? Is it, you know,
we
not everybody can go back 50 years or 30 years.
We don't teach it.
And
the answer is we don't teach it.
Yeah.
We don't teach it. And if you don't
right.
learn
or
history,
won't accept
it is bound to repeat itself. How many times have you heard that phrase?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the people who do know history, many of the people who do know history are aware of history, find it inconvenient.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if it is
some
taught,
people.
It's mistaught. Yeah. So, for example, I think one of the most dangerous examples of this is the it's not a belief on the right. It's a teaching on the right. What they try to teach is that, quote unquote, the United States was founded as a Christian nation. Right.
Right.
That's the version of history they want us to believe. If you read the things that our founders said about religion, it would stand your hair up.
Right.
They were downright, especially when you're talking about people like Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson, downright hostile
So was John Adams.
Yeah, right. It's
deeply religious man, by the way.
Yeah. mm-hmm. Yeah, but opposed to right the admixture of church and state, and so yeah, we have a lot of misinformation. We have people adjusting history to their own liking. And then you have, you know, as Jeff points out, many, many millions of Americans who just don't know because they haven't been taught.
Right.
Or they don't read. They don't read about it.
Right.
You know, it's interesting to go to the source. If you
so
read the letters
that opinion?
What was that,
Henry? The question is, is the news?
I don't blame the news. I can't blame the news media. You know, we've talked about this how many times, has he, about the idea of the doubling of America. And this really is an issue where I can't blame the news because the news isn't there to teach. The news is there to give you the news. Read the news, make up your mind. But they don't do that so much anymore. They read the news the way they want you to hear it. But that's not history. That's not learning how to be a citizen. That's not learning how to appreciate what you have and how you have it. And to learn not to make the same mistakes again. And that's why when we talk about, for example, people bring up parallels between what's happening here and what was happening in the 1920s and early 30s in Germany, we're not Nazis. Okay, we're not the Nazi party. And why are you bringing up the Nazis? The Nazis were almost 100 years ago. Oh, okay, well, it doesn't matter because what they did and the history of what they did doesn't matter, so we don't know what to look for anymore, and we don't see it coming when it's coming or when it's here. And those that do see it are all considered to be hysterics.
Yeah.
Because people don't know. They don't understand. They don't read. They don't care. You can run all, for example, you can run all of the documentaries you want to about Hitler in Germany and have it all explained to you beautifully in maybe 5 one-hour segments so that you really can understand. Nobody watches them.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cares. All they want to watch are the battles. We won the war. We're strong. Go USA. And not learning lessons. And that's where our Constitution fails, because people don't understand it and they don't revere it. All they worry about is, what does the Constitution give me? Not, what does the Constitution require of me? The old words of John Kennedy, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Looking at the Constitution and saying, what does the Constitution give me? Gives me the right to own a gun. Gives me the right to say anything I want to about anybody at any time I want. It gives me the right to be a Christian and to make you be a Christian. And they don't worry about what it means in its totality for all of the people. And we've talked about John Locke, and we can talk about it ad infinitum, okay, ad nauseum to some people. But the truth of the matter is, we don't teach this stuff. We don't teach our children at an early age what these things mean, so they grow up believing in them. We just don't. And because of that, this is how democracy dies, when people don't care anymore. That's how a republic dies. When we let other people make our decisions for us instead of telling them what the decision should be.
Yeah. It's, Michael Beschloss, the historian, was on yesterday talking mm-hmm. about our failure to learn from history. And he rattled off a number of different instances. And certainly in our foreign policy, it seems like we never learn. We never learn. No matter how many times we make the same mistakes, we keep on making them. But there's also, he pointed out, a historical precedent. That's not that long ago in historical terms. It was 1918. We found out what happens when you have a president who doesn't care about a pandemic. 675,000 people died. That's about the number we're going to wind up with here pretty soon. Mm-hmm. We already knew that from history. We already knew that if there's not a coordinated national response to a national health emergency, we know what happens because history has taught us that. And nonetheless, we had this president, Donald Trump, running around saying it was a hoax. Right? If he wasn't ignoring it, he was actively downplaying. So what happened? History repeated itself. Talk about the problems that we're facing. There are so many different inputs. And I agree with Jeff that there's two different the media and history are two different things. But I do think there's one commonality, which is misinformation about both. Right? We're constantly bombarded with false narratives of history or ignorance of history. And we're constantly bombarded by the mass media with entertainment rather than information. And in fact, this was I thought this was remarkable. The radio host I was talking about, Mark Bernier, who died of COVID after being an anti-vaxxer, his radio station released a statement, and here's what they said. They're grieving for Mark Bernier, who, this is quote, who informed and entertained listeners for over 30 years. There you go. In three words, one phrase, the problem. They said he informed and entertained. Informed and entertained.
That's what they said about Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, right. And
he informed and entertained.
Those,
he was entertained.
They're mute. Yeah, those are mutually exclusive. If you're entertaining me, you're not informing me. Right, and so you have, and again, I'm not into false equivalents. I don't see an equivalent on the left. On the right, you have these news outlets, Fox, OAN, Newsmax, the dark web, right, where a lot of this communication is going on. You can pull up, you know, people who are much more astute with technology than I am, they get into these websites where people on the right, they're swarming. And that's where you will see discussion threads. You can't, I say this every week, you can't make this stuff up, where people are having serious discussions about, do you put the horse dewormer, do you rub it in your armpits, or do you swallow it? These discussions are going on out there in social media. And you've got to the point where you have people like Rand Paul and Johnson out of Wisconsin saying, well, they're just kind of agnostic about taking horse medicine. Ron Johnson. We're just kind of agnostic about taking horse medicine. It's probably worth looking into. That's the common thread. We have alternate versions of history that are bunk, and we have however you define the media anymore, a media structure, right? If you look at it as an institution, that where we're dealing with completely different realities. So that's and that's where I don't know how you communicate with. I don't know how you reason. You see a lot of
you don't reason with people who don't know how to reason. They don't have the ability to reason. They don't have the ability to explain the way they feel. They just feel.
Mm-hmm.
There's no rationality to the thought process over a number of people. You know, there's no rational reason other than you just don't like the feel of a mask not to wear a mask. Okay? Mm-hmm. But no, it's my freedom not to wear a mask. And if I want to spread disease, I'm entitled to spread disease. And if I get sick, then even if I don't have insurance, I'll get treated. So what do I care? And that, there's no reasoning with people who think that way. There's no reasoning with a guy who straps on his AR-15 to his chest and walks into a Denny's to have breakfast. How do you talk rationally to a person who does that? This is not about rational thought. That's the problem. It's not about rational thought. It's the same thing as, and it leads me to something, and it does fit in, this officer who shot Ashley Babbitt, who was clearly, As a vet, trying to break her way into the House of Representatives to fulfill her mission, as was every other person banging at those doors, to get to the Speaker of the House, to get to members of the House, to cause as much disruption and injury as she possibly could. And now, for some reason, people want to make her, because Donald Trump tells them to, into a martyr for his cause. She is a martyr, like the 13 who died in the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923, who were revered every year with their own memorial buried in cement. And Ashley Babbitt is his martyr. And people believe that. She was murdered. She wasn't murdered. They should thank their lucky stars that the Capitol Police out front didn't just pull their weapons and start shooting people. And they were justified in doing it. Their lives were being threatened. Members of their own ranks were being dragged and beaten. And they were fully, in my opinion, they were fully authorized and fully, it would have been fully appropriate for them to start shooting people. Watch how fast all those brave people run down the stairs that they just walked up. I told Brendan a story that comes out of the movie about Wyatt Earp, which apparently happens to be a true story. When Wyatt Earp was all by himself and guarding some guy who had killed a very popular miner, and all the miners came up, there were 25 or 30 of them, and they got their pickaxes and they got all kinds of stuff, and they want to hang this guy. And Wyatt Earp walks out with two guns in his hands. He says, you know, there's a lot of you. You can get me. But I'm going to take a lot of you with me. And the one guy says, you can't kill us all. And he says, yeah, but I'm going to start with you. Okay? And then I'm going to kill you. And then I'm, and he points to the people and calls them by name. So come on, if you're that brave, come on. And after about 30 seconds of thought, they turned around and walked away. Okay? And if you notice, when Ashley Babbitt got shot, how quick that charge of all those people to get into the House of Representatives through those doors stopped.
Right.
It stopped. Because everybody's brave in a crowd till somebody dies. And then all of a sudden, I don't want to be him. And I'm one of those people that is still wondering why these armed police officers who had, fighting for their lives, refused to use their firearms. They're to be admired for doing that. They could have taken a number of lives. We could have had hundreds killed that day. And it would have been the start of the next revolution, no question about it. But this is the irrationality of these people. All of a sudden, this woman is a martyr to be revered. She's a criminal. She was threatening the lives of our representatives, trying to disrupt Congress and trying to overthrow the government, and somehow she's not a criminal? I don't give a damn about her service anymore. She deserved what happened to her. And this officer deserves to be credited for stopping those people by doing what he did. You stand there and point a gun at somebody and say, don't go through that window, I'm going to shoot you, and you ignore him, then you deserve what you get. I dare you to shoot me. Okay. Like taking the gun out of my cold, dead hand. Okay, I will. And people follow this and believe this stuff. She's a martyr to the country. She's not a martyr to the country. She's a traitor. Benedict Arnold should come back and get the Congressional Medal of Honor? Give me a break. And this is what we have been reduced to. Threatening the life of a police officer who did his duty. Putting a target on his back, and the former president of the United States basically sanctioning his assassination by saying that Ashley Babbitt was murdered. I wonder if he felt the same if Ashley Babbitt was coming into the White House to get him. But this is what happens when you don't. But people don't understand. They don't want to understand. They don't want to know. They just want to feel. Here's what I'm going to blame it. I'm going to blame it on that everybody gets a trophy. want to make sure you feel good about yourself. We don't care that you learn losing from winning. Here's your trophy because you participated. Even if you lost every game 20 to nothing, it doesn't matter. Here's your trophy.
Yeah, that's
okay.
And acting out, you know, people acting out. That's
right.
That's, yeah,
right.
Whether it's rioting at the Capitol or, you know, it's people running around screaming at other people, harassing people who are wearing masks, refusing to comply with public health requirements. I mean, it's just a sense of entitlement and privilege, and acting out on it. And you know, Hezzy always asked a good question: as so then what? So what do you do?
You know, it,
right?
Yeah. It's like you can run around and tell people that it's my choice not to wear a mask, but it's not your choice to wear one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. I mean, that's their thought process. What kind of jerk are you wearing a mask? Well, it's my choice. Yeah, but you're a jerk for wearing a mask. Well, I think you're a jerk for not wearing a mask. How do you like that?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Talk about breakdown in the discourse. There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So discourse doesn't work. Reasoning doesn't work. So then what does? And I don't know. I think the answer is, I don't know, you know, marginalizing people, shaming people. I don't know. I don't
know
what the, just ignoring them. I don't know.
We
can't ignore
have
them.
We have two lost generations. I hate to say this. We have two lost generations, and what we have to work on is the new generation coming up and teaching them. We who know better have to make the way to get those kids educated. So when they grow up, they can look at their dads like I looked at my father and said, "You don't know what the hell you're talking about, Dad. We're the smartest generation ever." I got a daughter that's like that. Okay? She thinks everybody in their 30s knows everything there is to know about life, and we don't know what we're talking about. Sound new to you, Hezzy? Okay, new?
Very.
I mean... Okay, I mean, we need to have children who fight with us, not children who just want to be us.
Mm.
And the only way they learn to fight with us is to get smarter than us, not think they're smarter. I mean, really be smarter. Okay, I mean, I don't care what you think about yourself. I care about what you really are.
I've already been eclipsed.
So,
let me tell
you. Well, according to my kids, I have been too, but that's beside the point.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay. My kids are in their 30s, okay? And they know everything there is to know, okay? There's nothing I can teach them about life, okay?
Well,
because,
I've already been
eclipsed
by my nephews, and they're 12 and 10, so don't feel too bad about it.
Yeah, you know, go away. Leave me alone. Okay, okay. That's why I wanted to sit on my porch, okay, and just breathe,
right.
Okay, okay, because
right.
It's something I know how to do, okay, okay,
yeah.
Okay. I brought up January 6th, and I want to talk about this for a minute. It's just something that we agreed we were going to talk about, and it's important.
Yeah, yeah.
A disclosure was made. Obviously, someone within the committee or a committee staff person was authorized to leak this to the news, even though it was supposed to be, quote, secret, close quote, okay? The select committee has a list of people that they're interested in subpoenaing records for. And in particular, they want their phone records, which includes texts and emails and phone calls. And they've ordered the companies who maintain those records to continue to maintain them. They are not to be deleted, even by the user. Okay, they should be preserved. And it's an interesting group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And see if you recognize any of these names. Lauren Boebert of Colorado. Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. I'm saving the best for last. Andy Biggs of Arizona. Paul Gosar of Arizona. Mo Brooks of Alabama. Madison Cawthorn of North Carolina. Here's one of our favorites. Matt Gaetz of Florida. And the most appropriately named person in the entire United States, Louis Gohmert of Texas. Okay? And then a couple that you probably haven't heard of, Jody Heiss and Scott Perry. But here's the biggie. This guy was named as a member of the committee by McCarthy. Give you a few hints. Never wears a sports jacket. Rolls up his sleeves. Okay? Jim Jordan of Ohio, who finally admitted that he had numerous conversations with the president, then president of the United States, while the Capitol riot was going on. And guess who his sidekick was? Here's a pair for you. This is like Abbott, hey Abbott, and Costello. He's sitting with Matt Gaetz. Is that a pair of people? And the funny part is that Jim Jordan can't remember what the conversations were about, just like he can't remember seeing that coach at Ohio State abusing the wrestlers that he was coaching. He can't remember that. He's getting really good at not remembering things. And if his memory is that bad, then he really should go in to determine whether he's going into pre-senility. Okay? Because one can remember seeing a coach abusing another guy. And you can remember if you're yelling and screaming at the President of the United States to call off the dogs. It would seem to me you could remember something like that. You might have a corner in your mind. Okay?
No, a conversation with the President of the United States in the middle of an insurrection, how would you remember something like that?
How could you possibly remember something like that? It's just a blip in your time, okay?
Right.
Okay, in numerous conversations. It's not like remembering one. It's like, oh, I'm having, you know, amnesia, okay? You know, I'm having a traumatic amnesia, and I can't remember anything that happened that day. I have no idea that I was scared out of my mind, tough guy. I'm a tough guy, but I can't remember being scared out of my mind that someone was going to kill me, that the mob was going to get me. I can't remember that. Wait a minute, you don't want to do this to me? I'm Jim Jordan. I'm on your side. It just flips me out. It's going to be very interesting to see when they subpoena these things. Okay, what's going to come out? They really want Boebert, though. They think Boebert really helped the insurrectionists before the insurrection. They think Boebert was involved in giving them information from inside, like a little tweet that said the speaker has left the building. Why are you texting this, except for to let people outside know you're not going to get her? They want her so bad. She can tend bar at the federal prison that she's going to be in. So I thought that was a very interesting story. I can't wait to see what comes out of all these texts.
Yeah, right.
I really can't.
Yeah.
This committee's taking this real serious.
And now
the Republicans are fighting, say, you can't make a congressman testify before Congress. Excuse me, congressmen testify before committees all the time.
Yeah.
To push their bills. Oh, I testify when I want to, not when you make me.
Right.
No, not going to happen.
Yeah. And, so, and all the claims of privilege that are coming are all ridiculous, too. Trump's going to claim that. That's all, those conversations are privileged, you know. Another news flash. Supreme Court has already addressed that. You don't have a privilege to discuss information
crimes.
Relating to crimes. Yeah, right. So
I think Nixon coming back from the grave would explain that to you.
Then
again, remember, that was 50 years ago, and, you know, we weren't around then. It doesn't count.
Yeah, right, right.
So it's going to be very interesting to see exactly how far this goes and what they find. But, I you know, now McCarthy's claiming that it should be part, that their text messages among each other, okay, should be part of the legislative privilege to say whatever you want on the floor of the House. It's an extension of that. He calls it an authoritarian undertaking. Has no place in the House of Representatives. This guy's scared for himself because he's going to testify.
Right.
And what they're afraid of is that it's not so much retribution from Trump, but being forced to say the things that they did and they said to Trump is an admission that they know that Trump was in control of the mob. They were aware he was in control of the mob. And they disapproved of what he was doing. That's what they're afraid of. And it hurts them with their base. It's not about the country. It's about their phony baloney job.
Right. Well, that's a good sound effect to end on.
We never got to DeSantis. Boy, we were ready to take him on. We never got on to the sentencing of that guy up in Michigan. I guess we can talk about that. And I really want to talk about it next week. I don't want to forget. What was that?
Save that then for next week.
Yeah. There's an order that came from a Michigan federal judge that I really want to talk about that relates to the claims that were made in front of her regarding election fraud and what she did to the lawyers who were involved in all of that.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that next week. Do that next week.
It'll still be there for a while.
Yep. It'll still be there. It'll be sitting front and center on my desk. How's that?
Good.
So.
Okay. Never a shortage of things to talk about. So.
No, there's not. There's not. And I'm enjoying it immensely right now. Well, if you can call this enjoyment. The things we're talking about are not enjoyable, but doing it is enjoyable. How's that?
Yeah.
Hezzy, thank you for your hour.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hezzy.
Always a learning experience. Well, thank you, Brendan. Thank you, Jeff. All the best.
We'll talk to you next week.
Take
care of yourself.
Yeah.
Enjoy. Bye-bye.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
How exciting. Always great. WMU Cooley, Tampa, Florida law professors, Jeffrey Swartz, Brendan Beery, Jeffrey Swartz. It's a wonderful, wonderful conversation. So that's really terrific. Well, let's move on to some other things that have become pertinent of late. Let me move on to a couple of things here. This is a very interesting woman's rights dissertation. This one was published by Franz Van Capt. Was issued a few days back, but I think you'll find it really interesting. It's the video is by Leila Jacinto, and it speaks to after 20 years of considerable gains and with much more still to do, the Afghan women's rights activists are battling rage and disappointment as they enter another chapter in the fight for gender rights. But the Taliban has still not provided clarity on its inconsistent statements, and they fear that will come too late when the world stops paying attention. Really brilliant concept and deduction. So let's hear this report. think you'll find it very, very interesting. Bear with me a moment. One second. Okay, we're gonna skip this commercial and move on straight.
You wrote a story on our website about Afghan women confronting a future under Taliban regime. What does this mean for the women's rights movement in the country?
Well, in short, it is all up in the air. You know, they're still trying to figure out what they're going to do. I profiled two leading Afghan women's rights activists. One is Mahbuba Sarraj. She is a veteran Afghan human rights campaigner. And the other was Sunita Viswanath. She's the co-founder of one of Afghanistan's largest women's organizations. Now, when I tried to reach, you know, local women's rights activists inside Afghanistan, I've been covering this for since the 1990s, it was very marked how few women were willing to speak to me. Phones were put off. You know, this is the level of threat that Afghan women's rights activists face. So there are a few courageous women speaking out in public. And what I heard was, you know, security is a big concern. So Sunita Viswanath, whose organization runs domestic violence shelters and other programs for women across Afghanistan, they've been doing it for the past 20 years. She is no stranger to, you know, the society and the security threats. And she told me that this is the grimmest moment in the organization's 20 years on the job. Right now, she is in New York right now, and she has an organization with a staff of around 1,200 women campaigners, and she has whittled it down to a list of 500 women staffers, including and survivors, who are most at risk. These are women who are prominent campaigners. They've spoken out publicly against the Taliban, and she told me that the U.S. government is one of the organization's largest funders, the main funder, and she has not managed to get out these 500 high-risk women. And she says this is a cruel joke. Mahbuba Sarraj is staying in Afghanistan. She's staying put in Kabul. When I asked her, are you not afraid? She said that she's 73 years old. The best years of her life are behind her. And she is going to be there for Afghan women. The problem, though, is the Taliban there for Afghan women? And what the Taliban have been saying, as viewers have seen in Catherine Nordstrom's reporting, is that the Taliban have been preparing for this moment for years. But they have taken Kabul, but they are still not detailed what exactly do they mean by women's rights under an Islamic framework.
And given that there's so much uncertainty, when you talk to these women, what do you think their plans are going forward?
Both women say that they would really like to continue their work in Afghanistan. Mahbuba Sarraj says that she can actually provide the kind of services that the Taliban has no experience of. But she admits that, you know, before the Taliban took Kabul, they had control of all these rural areas. And she admits that she was never able to run her programs in Taliban-controlled areas. It is completely inconsistent. You know, they say one thing to the international community. They message a different message to local domestic Afghans. And on the ground, it's completely inconsistent what the, you know, Islamist commanders do. So she says that she will adapt her programs if she's given a chance to work. Sunita Viswanath, too, you know, kept telling me that the organization has always respected Afghan cultural and religious, the culture of Afghanistan. They have not done anything un-Islamic. But she is wondering, since one of her major funders is the U.S. government, whether they will be allowed to continue their work. But every single Afghan woman that I spoke to who has been part of the movement, they all have one message. They keep repeating, please do not let Afghanistan disappear. Please keep the focus on Afghanistan so that the international community, or at least the West, does not recognize the Taliban. Because they are absolutely sure that once and if the Taliban gets recognition by the U.S. and its allies, its conduct on the ground will be completely different with what they have promised, and they fear that all hope will be lost.
I think that's a really good place to end. Leela, just answer.
Okay, bear with me a moment. This is another thing that is Afghans are facing an uncertain future. Bear with me a moment. 1 second. Okay, 1 sec. Okay.
My first question is, of course, how concerned are you about this final pullout of U.S. forces and the situation they're leaving behind, of course, in Afghanistan?
Of course, very concerned, as all Afghans are today. And we have to say, we have to remind everyone that the evacuations can't happen, can't stop with the chaos that we saw at Kabul Airport. So President Macron and other governments are now trying to negotiate safe access for Afghans to be able to continue to leave. Afghans in danger. We need to ensure that such a sensitive operation can happen in safety so that those who are still on the list, Afghans at risk, who are still on the list to be evacuated to France, Italy, UK, and the US can still leave the country safely. The Taliban have publicly announced that they would allow for that if Afghans have proper travel authorizations. Now, what we need to remind everyone is that most Afghans don't have passports. So what we need to see is a concerted effort that we didn't see at Kabul Airport, between, for example, European governments to provide travel authorizations, invitation letters to these Afghans. Some of them are students who are accepted in universities in Europe. Some of them are musicians and artists who we know have been targeted. They've been targeted killings of musicians and comedians in the past 2 weeks. And also researchers, professors, intellectuals, members of civil society who have their visas approved but can't leave the country at the moment. So we need to support them. And this is really the first immediate step of the negotiation that is happening and that needs to continue.
Just on that point, do we have a clear idea of the numbers of people, foreigners and Afghan nationals, that are still waiting around Kabul, around the airport to leave?
Now they're waiting at home. They're waiting at home. There are thousands still on the list, again, approved to leave. So we need to focus on them in the first place. But then negotiations will need to continue beyond this population at under immediate risk, to also think about the women, the children left behind. So initially, the Taliban said that they would allow everyone to work. But recently, they've told women to stay at home, not to report to work. They're doing so only in a few sectors, for example, in the health sector. So most women right now are not allowed to work, and we see it already. We also saw on Sunday there was a very large meeting of the Ministry of Higher Education in a hall with hundreds and hundreds of men, but not one single woman. Before, that hall would have been filled 50% with women, also because the international community was there. So what we need to make sure is that that the UN keeps monitoring missions, a presence in Afghanistan, so that we keep monitoring the rights of women and children and youth left behind.
Now, following this pullout of U.S. forces, the Taliban has already been speaking of independence, great independence. In your own opinion, what does the future look like in Afghanistan under the insurgents' rule?
Well, first of all, they speak of independence, but 75% of the Afghan economy, more or less, is supported by international aid. So the economy, and a former UN official was saying it, could collapse within weeks. Why? Because the IMF is withholding funds, because the U.S. government is also withholding access, freezing access to the central bank reserves in Washington. So what we need is to be very careful. Negotiations can continue. Financial support should continue. And that doesn't mean recognizing the Taliban. It just means not putting the Afghan population under very strict economic conditions. We cannot have sanctions the way, for example, the U.S. has done in Iran. It will just end up hurting the Afghan population more. Right now, Afghans don't have access to their salaries. There are lines, hours of lines to withdraw money and only very limited amounts from ATM machines. There's panic. There's inflation. 20% of basic food costs have risen by 20%. So right now, we need to make sure that we can, first of all, support the Afghan economy, free up all these freezing of resources. Russia asked for it as well. We need to make sure that we do that. Otherwise, the health sector will crumble, the education sector will crumble, and institutions won't be there to govern the 40 million people. Then we need to ensure that there's enough access for humanitarian agencies on the ground and make that access, again, conditional to the fact that we need to monitor what happens on the ground. And third, we need to have more coordination among foreign governments, among donors, to make sure that the UN assistance mission to Afghanistan is rethought, reinforced, but also to ensure that there's a common response for the future of the Afghan people.
OK, Okay, Naseem Majidi from the Samuel Hall Research Center. That's all we have time for. Thank you very much.
This is next is going to be how the Taliban takeover is going to affect different places around the world. So bear with me a moment.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Access Asia here on France 24. Coming up, tens of thousands flee Afghanistan. Pakistan is receiving most of the refugees. Many, though, are walking towards an uncertain future. And fears of turmoil in Afghanistan could shake the wider region from emboldened extremist groups to political realignment. Let's take a look at what's at stake. And Japanese fishermen are angry over the handling of the Fukushima disaster. They say the government's decisions are damaging their industry and threatening their livelihoods. Now, images of the sweeping but scrambled evacuation operation in Kabul made headlines around the world, but far less reported were the tens of thousands who fled on foot, men, women, and children, some of whom are ethnic minorities. The decision to flee is not a light one. Refugees often have little to no rights and a horrible quality of life. Peter O'Brien reports.
Just barely past the border into Pakistan, these Afghan refugees have resorted to begging.
I am poor. I have to beg so I can live. I come from Kandahar.
There was a war going on. I have young children. We were forced to come here.
As more people flee the Taliban's rule and worsening security in their home country, crowds continue to grow at the crossing from Spin Boldak to Chaman, even if life in Pakistan doesn't hold much promise. Pakistani government says it can't take in any more Afghan refugees except if they need medical treatment or have residence rights. But the Chaman crossing remains open, and hundreds of thousands of Afghans have passed through it in the last 2 days, many with the help of smugglers. Afghanistan's neighbors take in its highest number of refugees, with almost 1.5 million living in Pakistan last year, the most of any country. Displaced Afghans have for a long time complained about being unwelcome there, with little access to employment and citizenship. Some are now even traveling the opposite way, repatriating to their homeland and hoping the Taliban will bring stability.
I'm returning to Ghazni now that peace has been established. We're happy to be returning back to our home. It's much better to go back and settle there.
But they are swimming against the tide. The UN's refugee agency has said more than 500,000 people could flee Afghanistan in the coming months.
So to find out what the turmoil means for the wider region, we can speak to Michael Kugelman from the Woodrow Wilson Center think tank. Mr. Kugelman, thank you for speaking to France 24. I want to begin with the wider region. How grave is the risk of a humanitarian crisis, of emboldened extremist groups, or this being a boon to the drug trade?
Certainly, I think there are considerable risks to the region, including from refugees. I think that the fact that the Taliban has declared an end to its war will minimize the number of refugees generated by increased violence. But there's been a worsening economic crisis in Afghanistan over the course of the last 2 years, which will be made worse by the fact that many countries, including the U.S., have sought to place sanctions on the new government, which means that we'll likely see new refugees spawned by economic distress trying to come into bordering countries, particularly Pakistan and Iran. I think the other major impact on the region will be the risk of terrorism and extremism. The Taliban's victory, coupled with the withdrawal of U.S. forces, will certainly galvanize militants from around the region, including those that typically targeted Pakistan and India. So indeed, there will be a heightened threat of terrorism for the countries that border Afghanistan.
Now, Pakistan has long been accused of covertly aiding the Taliban in Afghanistan, a charge the country denies. What does the Taliban mean for Pakistan's government? Is it something they're celebrating?
I argue that the Taliban victory in Afghanistan is both a blessing and a curse for Pakistan. It's a blessing, a victory, because Pakistan will now have a pro-Pakistan government in Afghanistan, something that it has not had since the end of 2001, when U.S. forces removed the Taliban from power. But there are risks for Pakistan of a Taliban government in Afghanistan. One is the heightened security risks. There's a terrorist group called the Pakistani Taliban, separate from the Afghan Taliban, that has had its leadership base in Afghanistan for quite some time and has staged attacks across the border in Pakistan. The Pakistani Taliban is one of the groups that will be emboldened by the Taliban victory in Afghanistan, meaning that Pakistan certainly could see the risk of stepped-up attacks by the Pakistani Taliban in Pakistan, particularly because this is a group that had already been stepping up attacks in Pakistan in recent months. Other point here is that Pakistan, I think, is at risk of losing some of its leverage over the Taliban. For many years, Pakistan had provided differing forms of support, sanctuary for Taliban leaders, military support for armed for Taliban fighters, as well as medical care. Now that the Taliban has Afghanistan to itself, and now that the Taliban is no longer fighting a war, the tools of leverage that Pakistan had been able to use vis-a-vis the Taliban may not be there anymore. So ironically enough, Pakistan's relationship with the Taliban could well suffer a bit of a blow. It'll still remain strong, but given that Pakistan may lose some leverage over the Taliban, that might have an impact on the relationship between the two.
And I guess there are a lot of questions about engagement with the Taliban. Geopolitical flux certainly still playing out here. Could this Taliban takeover, if Pakistan engages a lot with the new government there, also a strained ties between Pakistan and India?
Well, I mean, India has been dealt a major strategic blow, and that is because the Taliban will be in power in Afghanistan. The Taliban has historically been an anti-India force. The Taliban, of course, is an asset of Pakistan's, and Pakistan will be able to step up its influence and role in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and also China. Pakistan's close friend and India's rival is also poised to step up its role in Afghanistan. And so I think what you're looking at here is a major transformation in which India used to be the Afghanistan's closest partner of all the South Asian countries, and yet now there likely won't even be a formal relationship between the Afghan government and India. And certainly this could have implications for the Pakistan-India relationship. Afghanistan has long been seen as a battleground for influence between Pakistan and India. India had a lot more influence in recent years because of its significant levels of economic and development assistance. But now things could change. Pakistan is going to be able to step in. That'll have major implications for this very difficult, strained India-Pakistan relationship.
All right, Michael, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much. Michael Krugelman from the Woodrow Wilson Center think tank. Now, a decade since the Fukushima meltdown, and problems remain. Earlier this year, the government decided that hundreds of tons of water used to keep damaged reactors cool will be released slowly into the Pacific Ocean. But not everyone is on board. Our team on the ground reports.
10 years after the nuclear accident, work at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station is far from complete. The biggest current issue is what to do with water that seeps into the reactor basements and mixes with water used to cool damaged nuclear fuel. The buildup of contaminated water is a challenge for TEPCO engineers, to pump out excess water, then treat and store it. Today, more than 1 million tons of water is being stored on site, and TEPCO is running out of space.
We're trying to reduce the quantity of contaminated water. In the beginning, we were collecting 400 to 500 tons of water per day. Today, it's 100 to 150 tons.
The facility's water treatment technology is unable to remove one radioactive element, tritium. This year, Japan's government decided it would release the water into the Pacific, a move supported by the International Atomic Energy Agency.
As per the official standard in our country, a rate below 60,000 becquerels of tritium in 1 liter of water is acceptable. There are no risks to health, even if you were to drink 2 liters of water with this concentration of tritium every day for 70 years. But we aim to release water at a rate that is 1/40th of that concentration, so it's very safe.
But Fukushima's fishermen are not convinced. After years of testing, fish in the region have been declared safe to eat. But food from Fukushima still has an image problem. As a result, some countries continue to ban imports of Fukushima produce. Fishermen say the decision to release the contaminated water into the ocean will destroy 10 years of hard work to rebuild their industry.
At first, when I heard their decision, I was shocked. But now it's building into anger.
Why did the government decide to put our livelihoods in danger without even discussing with us? Because of this, the price of local fish has fallen by 20 to 30%.
But at the local fish market, most of the people we met wanted to support the fishermen. And some said they believed the authorities were doing everything they could to protect the ocean.
I would be worried if they weren't taking any preventive measures. But they're testing all the fish, so I'm reassured.
I make a point of giving our child food from Fukushima. And now I'm pregnant again with our second child. We plan to do the same again.
Nuclear power plants around the world routinely release tritium into the sea. France's nuclear industry releases 10 times more in a year than TEPCO plans to do at Fukushima over several years.
Science says that releasing the tritium is not that harmful. People are just talking about the images. Oh, Fukushima, dangerous, scary. No, it's not. People are using it without the consideration of science, without the consideration of evidence.
Nearby South Korea and China, with which Japan has tricky relations, have condemned the water's release. While in Fukushima, some residents no longer trust the authorities. Some believe the accident has contaminated the water supply, like these 12 mothers who test local seawater twice a year. They collect 80 liters and analyze it at this laboratory, which they opened soon after the disaster with donations from around the world.
Radiation levels in the seawater are not high these days. As for tap water, the level was high just after the accident, but that's not the case today. It has stabilized. But personally, I am still concerned, so I use mineral water.
The women test about 200 items a month bought by local people, sand from parks, river water, vegetables. France 24 asked them to test peppers grown in Fukushima that we bought at a local supermarket. The test revealed no radioactive contamination. They're safe to eat. That's no surprise to these residents, but they'll continue to test items to prove Fukushima produce is safe. A decade on, almost all of the neighborhoods near Fukushima Daiichi have been decontaminated and some people have returned home. But the problem of pollution caused by the disaster continues. Even if it solves the water issue, TEPCO still faces the difficult task of decommissioning the plant, an expensive operation that's expected to last decades.
That's it for this edition. Thank you for watching and please stay tuned to France 24.
Okay, bear with me a moment here. We'll move on to some other issues. Concern, bear with me a second. One moment here. Okay, let's see if we can move on. Just check. About 11:30 now, local time. One second. Okay. One moment here. We'll see where we are. So when your page is open. Okay. One moment here. This I thought you might find very interesting. There's a rare meeting that took place between the Palestinian president and Israeli defense minister. So Israeli defense minister Benny Gantz met Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank on Sunday. It's the first official Israeli-Palestinian prime minister Naftali Bennett took office in June. Gantz traveled to the West Bank city of Ramallah, for security and economic discussions with the 85-year-old Palestinian leader. Officials said that on Monday. They came hours after Israeli Premier Bennett returned from Washington, where he met with U.S. President Joe Biden at the White House. Defense Minister Benny Gantz met with Palestinian Authority Chairman Mahmoud Abbas on Sunday evening to discuss security, policy, civilian, and economic issues. That's what the Israeli Defense Ministry said in a statement. Now, Gantz, who's the head of a centrist party in Israel's government coalition, told Abbas, quote, that Israel seeks to take measures that will strengthen the Palestinian Authority's economy. They also discussed shaping the security and economic situations in the West Bank and in Gaza, it added. They agreed to continue communicating further. Well, the meeting included the head of the Israeli military branch responsible for civil affairs in the Palestinian territories, Hassan Al-Yan, the senior Palestinian Authority official Hussein Al-Sheikh, and Palestinian intelligence chief Majid Fahai. Now, Al-Sheikh confirmed there's a meeting on Twitter, and Gantz's office said the defense minister and Abbas held, quote, a one-on-one meeting, quote-unquote, after the larger talks. Relations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, which is based in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, have deteriorated substantially in recent years. Former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in power from 2009 to 2021, was derided by Palestinians. He made no substantive efforts toward resolving the decades-old conflict while overseeing a steady expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank, communities regarded as illegal under international law. And Bennett is a hardline nationalist who opposes Palestinian statehood and previously led a powerful settler lobbying council. His office has made clear that Israel's ideologically disparate coalition, which includes left-wingers and hawks like the premier, have no plans to initiate a new round of peace talks. But top Israeli officials have indicated a desire to boost the Palestinian Authority amid concern over a fresh conflict with Hamas Islamists, who control Gaza and Israeli blockaded Palestinian territories that is separate from the West Bank. Well, 11 days of conflict between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza in May marked the worst hostilities in the area since 2014. And unrest has persisted despite an Egypt-brokered ceasefire. Abbas's Palestinian Authority has also come under mounting global criticism over an alleged crackdown on key rights following the death in Palestinian custody of a prominent activist. The United Nations and European Union last week expressed alarm over a spate of arrests targeting leading critics of Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. So we'll just have to see where all this goes. Let's just see one other thing, one second. One moment here. Okay. One second here. One second. All right. I think that that's it. I don't think that we have anything else that we've missed in order just to inform you of what's happening. So let me just quickly look and see one more thing, if there is anything here. All right, we'll see one moment. All right. much. This is a very interesting issue, which are normally not discussed, and that's about Qatar. So the question is why Qatar fosters close contact with the Taliban. Well, it seems that Qatar has long-standing ties with the Taliban, and while this approach is criticized by some, others benefit from the country's contacts. Qatar's main interest is to cement its position as a regional mediator. And just a few days ago, United States President Joe Biden picked up the phone to thank the Emir of Qatar, Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, for the generous support in the ongoing evacuation from Afghanistan. Well, Biden also thanked Qatar for facilitating intra-Afghan talks, even though they had failed even before the Taliban took power. So Germany, meanwhile, criticized Qatar after the Taliban's political leader, Mullah Abdul Hani Baradar, was flown to Kandahar from Doha by the Qatari Air Force days after the Islamist militants had swept across the country. Well, the relationship between Qatar and the Taliban is anything but new. As early as 2013, Qatar allowed the Taliban to open an office in Doha with the support of the United States administration under Barack Obama. At the time, Washington was looking for a neutral place to negotiate with the Islamist militia in order to prepare the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. I think the idea behind Doha initiating talks with the Taliban was the recognition that there may never be an outright military victory against them in Afghanistan, and that absent from such a victory, it may be necessary to bring them in part of a political solution. Ilham Fakhroo, an expert on Gulf states at the International Crisis Group, told Deutsche Welle, the German publication. Since 2018, Mullah Abdul Hani Baradar, who is one of the founding members of the Taliban, has led its representation in Qatar. Baradar is currently the Taliban political chief and has acted as the extremist's chief negotiator in talks with the United States and the now ousted Afghan government. In 2020, he signed a so-called peace agreement with the United States in Doha, but the Taliban's rapid rise to power has rendered the paper obsolete. However, it is also worth remembering that as little as 3 years ago, Baradar was released, reportedly at Washington's behest, from a prison in Pakistan where he had been detained in 2010 by Pakistani intelligence forces working together with the CIA. Now, after the fall of Kabul, Doha's ties to Afghanistan put it in a unique position. But some observers accuse Qatar of abetting international terrorism. Critics of the talks have also argued that the diplomatic engagement with the Taliban has only granted them some degree of legitimacy that they would not otherwise have had, said Ilham Fakhroo. The Doha-based TV station Al Jazeera has been giving the Taliban a platform to address the public for years. The station also broadcast the Taliban's entry into the presidential palace in Kabul. The emirate shows no fear of contact with several problematic actors in the region, Guido Steinberg of the German Institute for International and Security Affairs told Deutsche Welle. And during examples, further examples are Qatar's good relations with Iran and also with the Muslim Brotherhood, a transnational Sunni Islamist organization that has been designated by some countries as a terrorist organization. Well, Qatar has been presenting itself as a mediator in regional politics for almost two decades. And the primary reason is that it wants to improve its regional position. Steinberg had said, adding that in the past, Qatar was very independent, or very dependent, rather, on Saudi Arabia, In the 1970s and 80s, it was practically a Saudi protectorate, and Qatar wants to free itself from the embrace by its big neighbor by positioning itself as an independent mediator, he said. Well, point is, it's not an impartial mediator. With regard to the situation in Afghanistan, Qatar's foreign ministry, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, commented only a few days ago that the Emirate sees itself as an impartial mediator. However, the Emirate is not entirely impartial, as it set up the office for the Taliban, not least for the sake of the United States. Qatar is heavily dependent on U.S. protection, Steinberg had said. The U.S. maintains a large airbase in Al Udeid, and Qatar has no interest in changing that since it fears the power of its neighbors. Yet Qatar is certainly not appeasing other countries in the region with its foreign policy and its relations with extremist groups, which in 2017 resulted in the so-called Qatar crisis, when it was blockaded and boycotted by Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt. The dispute was officially settled in early 2021. However, analysts believe that the problems were pushed aside rather than resolved. By playing this role of mediation, Qatar is also able to strengthen its relations with the United States and other Western European actors, Elham Fakhro of the International Crisis Group had said. Meanwhile, another aspect remains unclear. How much influence does Qatar have on the Taliban? In the past, the relationship between Qatar and the Taliban has not been entirely free of conflict. For example, Qatar did not want the Taliban to hoist its flag at its headquarters in Doha or to call the building the representative office of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. And Qatar has also never officially recognized the Islamic Emirate proclaimed by the Taliban in 1996. Observers believe that it's also unlikely to happen this time, especially if the United States opposes it. Well, Qatar is officially a Wahhabi state and has contact with various extremist groups. Qatar is certainly not interested in the Taliban ruling by force, said Steinberg. Its interest, he says, is to act as mediator and, quote, to appear on the map of regional politics and also of world politics. In this way, Qatar could funnel interest in the West and perhaps also in China and Russia in its continued existence as an independent state. Undoubtedly, solidifying its existence is the most important motive behind Qatar's foreign policy. That's what Steinberg believes. And certain neighbors like Saudi Arabia don't necessarily think that Qatar actually needs to exist. Well, Western states, however, appreciate Qatar's services and contacts with the Taliban, despite the criticism. Germany's Afghanistan ambassador, Markus Potzel, has already held talks with the Taliban in Doha. And the European Union is also likely to make use of the Qataris' contacts with the extremists for upcoming talks with the Taliban. So anyway, so that's the story that we hear from Deutsche Welle. One second. Let me see. One second. And this is something new. The evolution of the coronavirus, evidently part of the coronavirus digest. South African scientists are monitoring a new, rare COVID-19 variant. Experts in South Africa are testing a new coronavirus variant to determine if it poses a threat. Germany's infection rate has fallen for the first time since early July, and scientists in South Africa are monitoring a new coronavirus variant that has been slowly spreading throughout the country and appears to have a high mutation rate, the country's National Institute for Communicable Diseases said on Monday. The variant known as C BA.1.2 was first identified in May and has not yet spread enough to qualify as a variant of interest or a variant of concern. However, scientists have observed that C.1.2 appears to mutate almost twice as fast as other global variants. The mutations also appear to be similar to those found in other variants with higher transmissibility and reduced sensitivity to antibodies. Scientists are carrying out tests to determine what effects these mutations have on the virus. This variant has been detected in each of South Africa's 9 provinces, as well as in several other countries, including the United Kingdom, New Zealand, and China. The variant, made up of just 1% of recorded COVID-19 samples in June, has grown to 3% in July. At the same time, the Delta variant accounted for 67 and 89% in those months, respectively. At this stage, we do not have experimental data to confirm how it reacts in terms of sensitivity to antibodies. The NICD researcher by the name of Penny Moore had said during a virtual press briefing, quote, "We have a considerable confidence that the vaccines that are being rolled out in South Africa will continue to protect us against severe illness and deaths," she added. Well, Australia will receive 500,000 doses of BioNTech Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine from Singapore later this week, after Prime Minister Scott Morrison had announced today. The deal is part of a straight swap arrangement that will see Australia return the favor in the same amount of doses later this year, but will allow the country to accelerate a flagging vaccination program and a surge in cases. Also in Australia, Canberra, the capital, on Tuesday extended its strict lockdown by a further 2 weeks as the capital city struggles to contain a spread of the highly infectious Delta variant. The extension of Canberra's lockdown is likely to soon be followed by a similar move in the state of Victoria. And Australia's second most populous state, which has been in lockdown for 5 weeks, is continuing to see a rise in infections, and State Premier Dan Andrews said that too many people remain unvaccinated to significantly ease restrictions. Nevertheless, Andrews did say that the state would outline on Wednesday a way forward as vaccination numbers rise. New Zealand on Tuesday saw a drop in cases for the second day in a row, with 49 new infections reported as the country's lockdown appear to be reversing a recent trend. "We want the tail of this outbreak to be as short as possible," Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern had told reporters. Well, in Europe, the nationwide 7-day incidence rate in Germany dropped slightly on Tuesday. It is the first time it has fallen more than a month and now stands at 74.8 new infections per 100,000 people over a 7-day period. The Robert Koch Institute, or Koch Institute for Infection Diseases, the RKI, recorded a 5,750 new cases in the previous 24 hours, bringing the total number of cases since the beginning of the pandemic to 3,942,856. There were also 60 new coronavirus deaths recorded in Germany, bringing the total death toll to 92,200. Now, a group of 149 Afghan evacuees who fled their homeland amid the Taliban takeover have been met by medical workers upon landing in North Macedonia and transferred to a hotel near Skopje, the capital, where they will be tested for the coronavirus. In the Americas, the United States has raised the travel risk alert for several European countries, including Germany, due to the high rate of COVID-19 cases in those countries. Switzerland, Estonia, North Macedonia, and Azerbaijan, as well as Germany, have been listed in the level 4 category, meaning that they are among the highest risk destinations for travelers, according to the latest advisory from the United States Centers for Disease Control, or the CDC. the Eastern Caribbean island nation of St. Lucia has also been added to the list. Hospitals in the southeastern U.S. state of Louisiana have largely escaped catastrophic damage from Hurricane Ida, but the storm did create the perfect petri dish for the spread of COVID, according to officials. The hurricane struck a state where hospitals are currently crowded with patients suffering from coronavirus, with a Delta variant spreading fast and nurses in short supply. A handful of smaller hospitals have been forced to evacuate patients, but it doesn't seem to appear to be anything catastrophic, Joseph Cantor, the top medical official in Louisiana, told news agency Reuters. So that's the story there. I think that is the end of our broadcast day. One second. Just one last thing. Poland is seeking a state of emergency over the Belarus border crossing. It seems that the Polish border is set to go into a 30-day state of emergency to further prevent refugees and migrants entering the country. The European Union has accused Belarus of purposefully sending migrants across the border. The Polish government on Tuesday today asked President Andrzej Duda to declare a state of emergency at the country's border with neighboring Belarus. The plan to impose a state of emergency along the border comes after some 3,000 migrants tried to enter the country from Belarus during August. Poland's government and the European Union believe the unauthorized crossings and attempted crossings are being orchestrated by Alexander Lukashenko's regime in Minsk, the capital of Belarus. Once approved, the emergency rules would ban demonstrations in a thin strip along the border as well. As obliging people to carry identity documentation, it would last for 30 days before requiring a renewal. Situation on the border with Belarus is a constant crisis. Poland's right-wing Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki had told reporters, "That is why we have decided to further this solution to the president." Migrants have also entered Latvia and Lithuania, two other European Union states bordering Belarus. Most of the migrants are from the Middle East and Afghanistan. Belarusian authorities have been accused of flying people into the country in order to send them into neighboring European Union states. The European Union believes that Lukashenko's strongman regime is trying to use immigration as a form of leverage against the bloc's stringent sanctions, so says Minsk. Well, Poland began the construction of a 2.5-meter tall fence along its 480 kilometers, that's about 260 miles, border last week. Well, the Polish government has taken a hard line in a bid to prevent refugees and migrants from entering the country and beginning asylum claim processes. The situation has, however, split the country, with a liberal opposition, non-governmental organizations, and the Catholic Church all criticizing the government's stance. Polls have also been divided about the fate of a particular third group suspected to have come from Afghanistan who have been stranded at the border for over 3 weeks. And Polish authorities arrested 13 activists over the weekend who had been protesting what they called inhuman behavior in the part of the government by cutting a hole in the new fence. So that is the tragedy there. We've come to the end of the wire for us, for our broadcast today. Bear with me a moment as I go back to our studios. So I wish you a good day. Thank you for being with us today. Always a pleasure. And thanks, of course, to Cooley Tampa, Florida law professors Jeff Schwartz and Brendan Beery. Brendan Beery and Jeff Schwartz. Always a pleasure to listen to their perspective. Take care and good day. Goodbye.